talking roundtable this afternoon on the Jays Journal podcast. With me are Chris Henderson, Eric Rosenheck, and Cole Shelton. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure having you join me. So let's look at the Blue Jays now. I mean, the All-Star game was a nice break, an exhibition game, and now we've got to get down to business. And the Tigers, the Red Sox, the Indians, they're serious baseball teams. They may be flawed baseball teams. We know that too. But we're looking at this road trip, and I'm going to start, Eric. What does this mean? Like, it seems like every group of games I keep referring to, let's say, an 8-game homestand, a 12-game road trip. I feel like this is the fourth time this year I've had to prepare for the fact that this could be the most important stretch.
Well, to be honest, it's going to be the most important stretch until the next most important stretch, to be honest with you.
I knew you were going to say that.
But, I mean, that's just how the season's gone. It's been a very, very inconsistent season. So just when we think they're going to go one direction, they suddenly do a U-turn, and we think, well, maybe there might be something still there. So it's just hard to say. And you know what? We're just going to have to, you know, we're not fortune tellers, and we're just going to have to let the games play themselves out. We've seen what the Jays can do in the second half. So we're just going to have to sit back and let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, and, you know, I agree with you. But that said, the one element, of course, that's with the importance of these games is that I think this road trip is really going to – it's one part of the, or one thing that I am concerned about or excited about, depending on how you want to look at it, is that this road trip kind of takes us to a point where they're at the trade deadline, essentially. By the time they're coming home, they'll have less than a week to operate. So I really feel like if they – come away with this from this road trip with a losing record, then it just makes the team much more likely to be sellers. And, you know, to what degree we'll see. But, you know, at this point, I'm surprised because what I'm reading this morning is, you know, they had scouts watching Sonny Gray last night and, you know, picking up Mick Gielgamontero before the All-Star break. They're not acting like sellers at all. So it'll be interesting to see what happens because if they can go ahead and take 6 or 7 or 8 of these games on this trip, then who knows? We could be serious buyers. Who knows?
I think it's definitely an important stretch with, just like they said, because if you have a losing record, you only have, like, what, the 4-game series against Oakland, I think, left before the All-Star break. But then, they might be sellers if they get, like, a losing record, but then I could see them be, like, kind of buyers. They sell off, like, they'll try to trade like Estrada and Liriano, the guys that are free agents. But like, and I could see them try to trade for like a controllable starting pitcher through like 2018 because they still want to go like forward in 2018. I don't think it's gonna be like a huge rebuild. They may just sell off the upcoming free agents.
Yeah, and I'd agree with that. You know, and I was concerned a couple weeks ago that they might strip it right down to a full on rebuild. And just based on what I'm seeing lately, it doesn't appear that that's going to be the case. And obviously a 180 can happen at any time. But pursuing somebody like Sonny Gray, I don't actually think that the Blue Jays are going to trade for him. But he's a good example of a guy who's, I think he's 27 years old right now. He's got 2 years left of control. Like, he's got 2 years left of arbitration. So that's the kind of guy that if the Blue Jays are serious about trying to compete in 2018 and 2019, I agree with you, Cole, that they may trade guys like Estrada, Liriano, Batista, guys that are on expiring contracts. But it looks like they're trying to angle towards next season, which is something I think the fans should be happy about.
We know, realistically, this team has very, very few actual tradable assets. I mean, let's face it, we're talking about them wanting to be buyers, being seriously considered now at this stage as maybe sellers, but it seems to me like they're both very, very weakened positions compared to other franchises with big payrolls. You know, you look at what the Cubs did. The Cubs did what they did, whether a person believes it was the right move, because they could. They have a deep farm system, they have a large payroll, and they're willing to take on the kinds of contracts to help them win now. Eric, do you think, knowing that aside from maybe Donaldson, Happ, and Estrada as really legitimate tradable assets, because talking about trading Marcus Stroman is only what silly folk like Buster Olney enjoy doing, knowing they have such few assets, can they realistically be considered any kind of impactful buyer?
You know, it's tough to call. It is tough to call, and you're absolutely right. Donaldson and Happ are probably the most valuable pieces that they have. I mean, if they really want to dive in and be buyers, then, you know, they're going to have to sort of flaunt out Bo Bichette and Vladdy Guerrero. But I don't think there's any Blue Jay fan or reporter or writer on this planet that wants to see them to do that. Even though, you know, prospects are really just crapshoots, to be honest. But, you know, no, I would agree. It's tough to say, but, you know, there are probably a lot of teams that are willing to pay King's ransom for Josh Donaldson. So, you know, if they do end up sellers, you know, they could, you know, definitely boost up their farm system through a trade with Donaldson.
I do think the Blue Jays have, I think they got some more value in the system than people give them credit for. But I think as much as, you know, I wouldn't even consider for a moment trading either Bichette or Guerrero. But I think there is enough other talent. I just don't think that other teams are going to be willing to accept it. You know, you look at the guys like, you know, say a Bradley Jones or, I mean, there's plenty of guys that are performing in the minor leagues right now, but, you know, when you're talking about an impactful player, like say a Sonny Gray, the A's are going to be asking for the best. And if the Blue Jays have any sense in their head at all, they're not going to consider trading those two guys on the bottom rungs there.
So like, I don't think they should trade Bichette or Guerrero, but if they do, like, they still do have prospects you trade. You could trade Rowdy Tellez if you could get an arm. You could look to trade Dwight Smith or Anthony Halford, they both like contributed in the MLB, and they look like they could be ready next year. And if a team wants that like young player ready to like step in, they could trade any of those three to get like a controllable arm. But like, I don't think you're gonna get that huge guy without trading like the Shadow Guerrero, which I don't think they should do.
I think we're grasping at straws, it sounds like. I don't think it's realistic to expect this organization to make the kind of drastic move to take this team over the top, knowing it's a huge risk. I mean, let me ask you this, Cole. If I were to tell you that this team could go out and get a top-ranked starter or a top-ranked position player, would you see them as being ready to contend for the division crown? Is the team good enough, even if they add the part that all fans deep down inside want them to?
I think you have to give it, like, I want to see if how, like, Sanchez can pitch and Estrada can pitch post the All-Star break. Because Sanchez, he's been hurt, and Estrada was on, like, he was not pitching good. So I think they have to stay healthy, and their pitching has to be good for them if they get, like, a top guy to contend. But then I still think they dug themselves such a big hole that, like, it'll be hard to, like, get that division. But the wild card, I definitely think they could get. And then it's just a who knows from there.
Yeah, like there's a lot of factors that have to go into it. And, you know, I haven't looked at the standings, but last time I did check, there were several teams still competing for the wild card spot. So there aren't a lot of teams that are pretty much selling right now, and everyone's still in it. So it's hard to say who's going to be willing to sort of make big moves during the as July 31st approaches.
Yeah, and I like the point that Cole made, too. You know, the Blue Jays are fortunate and unfortunate in that they're kind of getting a player, you know, in the second half by getting Aaron Sanchez back in the rotation. So that's it should be a huge lift for the team. And you're right, if Marco Estrada can turn things around, that's a second guy that has offered us virtually nothing in the last 6-7 weeks. So if you can get those two arms going, that makes a significant difference already. But beyond that, as far as like finding one player, I don't think there is one player that can make that difference for this team the way they performed in the first half. They would need those performances from guys that they were expecting anyway. But even, you know, if you added Mike Trout even to the roster in the first half, I don't think it would have made the difference. And as much as I think Mike Trout is an incredible baseball player, baseball is not a one-man game like, say, basketball, where, you know, LeBron James can put a bunch of scrubs around him in Cleveland early in his career and make the NBA Finals. It just doesn't work that way in baseball.
Boy, I'd like to take what you just said and put that as the you know, sound file when you boot up your Microsoft Windows PC or on your notebook, because that's a reminder for fans to understand that you've got to look to what happens not in the present but also for the future. Because knowing that it's a game where you have to construct a full roster of position players, starters, relievers, catchers, backup catchers, there's so many components that go into being a world championship team. And if you look at the last few World Series winners, they've all been on the fringes of what you'd call maybe a super team, definitely last year with Chicago, but even those Giants teams were just really well-constructed baseball clubs. And then when you read about somebody like a Pablo Sandoval being signed, and now they've released him with $95 million owing, you understand what kind of an investment game that franchises play with one another, with their to see whether or not they can get the kind of results they're hoping for. There are never any guarantees. Eric, I'm wondering, could you argue that when you make investment errors like the Sandoval signing, or if you look at it from a hockey perspective with what David Clarkson was for the Toronto Maple Leafs, does that mistake-prone approach, these errors, destroy the team's relationship with the fans? And should we really be paying attention to these kinds of mistakes in the way that we appreciate our team?
Well, to be honest, I don't know if it would wreck the relationship with the team between the team and the fan. I think it would more affect the relationship between the fans and, you know, the front office, the general manager, the president. You know, I think back to Alex Anthopoulos, and I remember way back in 2012, people were ready to, you know, get rid of this guy. There were people who were actually calling for him to be fired. And then, you know, he makes the blockbuster trades with Florida, or excuse me, Miami and the Mets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, say what you want with how everything turned out. You know, that kind of got him bought some love back from the fans. And, of course, 2015, let's face it, we got really spoiled with how well things turned out. And it just turned around people's perspective of Alex Anthopoulos. I mean, he's probably going to be viewed as a god in this city for hundreds of years, to be honest with you. In terms of bad investments, you know what? It happens. It happens. You can also look at J.P. Ricciardi. You think about A.J. Burnett or Frank Thomas. And we'll never, you know, we won't acknowledge that, you know, he also picked up Edwin and he picked up Jose. So I really think it just depends on, yeah. It really kind of involves the general manager and the front office.
Yeah, and I wrote an article that I published here on Saturday. About Sandoval, and I don't know if you guys remember, but the Blue Jays were actually after him in that 2014 offseason. And, you know, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, I think they went with a better decision.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, and it was so funny, you know, and I should almost pull it up in front of me because the timeline for events that happened there was pretty tight. I mean, we signed Russell Martin, I think it was on November the 18th, and then Sandoval signed with Boston, I think it was on November the 25th, and then the 28th was when the Blue Jays made the trade for Josh Donaldson. So there was obviously a lot of balls in the air at that point, and just thinking about how wrong or how badly it could have gone had one or two other decisions been made, my goodness, like, if we'd signed Sandoval, chances are Russell Martin doesn't get signed. Josh Donaldson obviously doesn't get traded for, and we don't make the playoffs for 2 years. There's no way. So that one decision could have been catastrophic for the franchise. I called the article "The Blue Jays Dodged a Bullet with Panda."
It's so hard too, because like Sandoval, he was so good in San Francisco. No one could have thought like this slide was happening. Like his weight was an issue, but like he was still a good hitter, and then like. He just went downhill so fast. Like, San Francisco, like, they would have wanted him back. Oh, it's so hard just to, like...
To project it is what I think you're saying at the end of the day. How do you project a player that... And I agree with you. When Sandoval had his great years and was MVP in the playoffs, all you could think about is what an asset he'd be to your team, right? But then the next thing you know, his weight issue hasn't completely disappeared. And then there's this startling regression. And then you kind of wonder, well, how do these other players, like the Beltrays of the world, take care of themselves? You know, he's not a small player, and yet he's remained a phenomenally consistent hitter. What's your take on that, Cole? Why are some hitters just able to play well into their, you know, late 30s, early 40s, while others start to drop off at 31, 32?
It's such a big question. It could be, like, the ballpark they play in, like where they're hitting in the the batting order, who's behind them, if they get good pitches to hit. If they're batting like sixth and the 7, 8, 9 aren't good hitters, chances are they're not going to get many good pitches to hit.
Yeah, it could be just simple genetics, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some players can stay in shape all the way till they're 40, and some, you know, sometimes just regression just happens early. It's just a fact of life, to be honest.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. And, you know, you look at a guy like Devin Travis, I don't think anybody would say that he's lazy or he's got a poor attitude, but his knees just haven't been holding up for him so far in his career, and hopefully that'll change. But, you know, in other cases, you look at somebody like Beltre, and he's been a noted workhorse in the gym and is, you know, on top of his fitness and was really on top of that. In the case of Sandoval, the guy got his big contract and, And he wanted out of San Francisco at the time because they were putting weight restrictions and trying to get him to, you know, eat on certain diets and stuff, which was really, frankly, for the betterment of his health and the betterment of his career. There's no excuse for being out of shape when you're being paid $19 million a year. So
yeah.
I don't feel bad for Sandoval at all. And to look at somebody like Beltre is just all the more reason why Pablo should be ashamed of himself. Like, it's just to let your weight get out of control like that when you're getting paid that much and you have a medical staff right there that's willing to help you. That's just pure laziness and apathy. And thank God Blue Jays don't have to deal with him.
He did give us a good laugh, though, last year when R.A. Dickey threw him a knuckleball and he swung right and swung missed and his belt came off.
That was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I sent that mm-hmm. GIF or however you say it. I sent that to a lot of my friends that are Red Sox rooters, and yeah, I enjoyed that for a while.
Well, and Red Sox fans can't be very pleased with what's happened there, but I don't think they're too worried. Their team is trending exactly where I thought they'd go. I want to ask the three of you, and maybe start with Eric. Jose Bautista came out in the media yesterday and said that he basically wants management to keep this group together. Some nice sentiments in that regard, along with some really interesting timing and words, because nothing that comes out of Jose Bautista's mouth is usually random. He's a very, very calculating fellow in the way he deals with the fans and the media. Is this a rallying cry to salvage the year? Is that how you interpreted his words?
To be honest, I'm not surprised he said that. First of all, he gave a great smile, which has completely gone viral. And second of all, I mean, the thing is, what is he, you know, it's not, he can't say, well, I think we need to rebuild. No player's going to say that. No player's going to say, well, I just don't think that this is going to work out. Jose is, you know, kind of saying the right things with that. And yeah, there is a little bit of subtext he's trying to get across, but, you know, I'd be more concerned if he was saying, yeah, I think it's time to rebuild and trade everybody.
Yeah, I agree with you especially on the subtext point. And, you know, for a guy like Bautista, this is a crucial point. You know, if this roster decides to rebuild, then there's a very, very small chance that they'll consider bringing him back next year. And as we saw in the offseason this last year, there wasn't the kind of interest for him that he was hoping for. So selfishly for his own career, the best thing that could happen is for the Blue Jays to stay competitive and to keep this window open, because that's going to make him more money, keep him on a relevant team, and it's just going to be better for him in every way. So I do think, obviously, he unselfishly wants the team to do well as well, but selfishly, he definitely stands to gain if the Blue Jays are more competitive.
Yeah, and like both of them said, no player is going to come out and say, like, oh, our team's not good enough to make the playoffs. Every player on every team believes their team is good enough to win. So, like, Bautista just said, like, what everyone would have expected. And like Chris said, he wants to stay on the competitive team because there is there's a chance that if the Jays want to keep him in 2018, Bautista might be back. They might bring him back another one-year deal. Who knows? But like if they rebuild, they're not going to bring him back. Then what is the market for him?
Well, I really found the timing of his words fascinating, and also the reasons behind it. Because if you think about it, Jose Bautista at this stage in the game really can't benefit or lose unless he goes out and actually performs for his own interests, regardless of what the team is doing. If he does extremely well in the second half, he might get some interest from suitors next year, including the Blue Jays. And if he struggles mightily, then it was a one-off attempt by the team to try to keep a player that is climbing up the RBI charts. You know, you just tied my childhood hero, George Bell, for RBIs. I just found it very fascinating listening to him talk about it in a way where he really has no reason to say it other than his own desire to maybe try to find one last competitive year in what might be the end of his tenure as a Blue Jay. Is he going to come back next year one way or another? Chris, what do you think?
The only way I can see him returning is if the team feels that they can compete. And, you know, what did he get, $18.5 million this year? I don't think he's going to get anywhere near that, whether it's from the Blue Jays or anyone else. I do think the Blue Jays will be willing to pay him more than most other franchises, but unless the team views themselves as a competitor next year, I don't see a point in bringing him back other than you know, a fan or a nostalgia thing, I guess. But I don't see it happening. Even if they are competitive, maybe, you know, it would have to be a discount. You know, if he's willing to sign a one-year, $10 million deal next year to join a contender, maybe. But otherwise, I don't see it.
You know, selfishly, I'd love it if they brought him back and if he retired as a Blue Jay. But, you know, that's just my heart talking. My head says, you know what? If it's time to move on, it's time to move on. You know, Ari, you talked about George Bell. And I've been thinking about Bell and Barfield and Mosby. You know, when they first made that first playoff run in 85, they were the three, you know, they were the main, the big stars of the team, them and Fernandez. And yet, you know, over that time, you know, they had to evolve. And by the time they won that first World Series, none of those players were here. So it's just kind of evolution and retooling. So, you know, Batista's kind of in that frame where, you know what, maybe he's part of that journey, but he won't be right there at the end when they achieve the significant goal.
I can't see him being back because I think they want to, like, give Alfred a look. And then if he takes over, say, right field, so where do you put Batista? You have Smoke and Morales at first base, designated, like, DH. So there's not really a spot for him to play. And, but, like, I could see the Jays maybe just giving him, like, a 1 year, like, $10 million, like Chris said, and just be, like, just kind of, like, on the team. He'll play, like, the odd game at right field, off the bench, just so he can, like, retire a Jay. Because he is one of, like, the best Jays of all time.
And could we say, just for argument's sake, that he was kind of the backup option because they really wanted Dexter Fowler?
Non-question.
Oh, absolutely. I think he was a backup option to Fowler and to Encarnacion.
Well, and as far as backup options go, Eric, I like the analogy that you drew with those Blue Jays that had to lay down the bricks, you know, the foundation in order for the 1992 and 1993 teams to get over the hump. And I think there is some of that, especially when you think of Tony Fernandez, who was a player that the organization simply coveted from the day they discovered him as a 13-year-old in, you know, the sandlots of San Pedro de Macorís. So if you think about it, Jose Bautista became a star because he was a Blue Jay, and the Blue Jay became relevant in this city because of Jose Bautista. And I think the organization understands that, especially the upper management ownership group, you know, Edward Rogers. He knows that if not for what Bautista was able to do during those horribly lean years of really bad baseball, then we never would have had the opportunity, I think, in the last couple of years to appreciate what the Blue Jays were able to do as a real baseball team.
You hit the nail right on the head, because I always feel that when you're looking back at this era of Blue Jays baseball, which I would say is starts from the end of the 2009 season, ground zero of that history, of that era, starts with two people, A.A. and Jose Bautista.
Yeah.
Agreed, totally. And, I think what you said there, Ari, with the front office appreciating him, I honestly think that's why he got the contract he did last year. You know, obviously he was a backup option, like we talked about, for some of the other people that they were pursuing. But even to pay him $18.5 million for the year, I can't imagine that anybody else was offering that much money. I know there was other reports that the Rays and other teams were interested, but, you know, I think the Cleveland was interested at one point. But I felt like it was one of those cases where I was like, well, we have a little bit of payroll because we struck out on who we were after, so we have the money. Let's reward this guy who's been crucial to the franchise, which I'm okay with. But I just felt like it, you know, I was surprised that he got as much money as he did, and I don't think he'll get anywhere near that next year, whether it's in Toronto or somewhere else.
Yeah, I can't see him making a whole lot either. I think, like, what do you think, like, a good market is? Like, 13, 14 maybe for him?
Yeah, it all depends. You know, I would, if I was the GM, I wouldn't spend any more than that, that's for sure.
If I'm a baseball GM, I'm also looking at his inconsistency, and that's going to keep me away. I don't want a baseball player who 3 months of the year hits under 200 and the other 3 months overcompensates with, you know, a 450 on-base percentage. I think his lack of consistency has hurt him enormously, but there's no question that there'll be a team who will find him as a valuable asset. And by then, it'll be his, you know, 1 or 2 years before he finally retires and goes into the sunset. Guys, this has been an excellent round table. I have one more question that I want to pose, and I'll start with Cole, and we'll go around the table. I was thinking about the fact that baseball, in many respects, has modernized for better and for worse. It's always encouraging, I think, when it learns from mistakes, like, for example, the All-Star game. It's an exhibition game and should be so. The fact that it was something that we had to endure as determining the outcome of home field advantage in the World Series was as absolutely ridiculous as a fan exasperatingly can accept, I think. But they also make mistakes for every good thing they do. For example, getting rid of the intentional walk the way they have. How long to change three plays. The game is, I think, still too long and can be very boring. But now this year, home runs are flying at a record pace. There are more injuries than ever before, blister complaints, guaranteed contracts, the likes that we are anticipating that we've never, ever seen before, bad decisions left, right, and center on a business level. Cole, how do you feel about what the game is today? Are you happy with what the product of baseball is at the highest level?
I definitely think it is a bit too long, because if they're trying to attract like the younger generation, not a lot of people have like the like are gonna want and sit there for 3.5-4 hours. Some games are going to watch like a 1-0 game, but with like the increase of home runs, it's brought more excitement to the game. But like with that, like people are saying that's what's causing the blisters, which it might be the ball. It might just be like how they're adjusting their grip or like the weather. But I do think baseball's in a good spot right now, especially after changing the All-Star game, which was awful. I don't know why they would ever make that part of the World Series. Or like,
to be honest, the sport's never going to be perfect. And, you know, there's a number of ways you could try it, but there's always going to be some kind of complaint. You know, one thing I've always noticed, or in the last recent years, is that, you know, our society craves quick and aggressive results and items and things, and baseball just doesn't really conform to that. So you can certainly make different ways to you know, come up with different suggestions to get fans, but it's, you know, it's never going to be a perfect suggestion. And no matter how hard people are going to try, you know, the game is going to be what it is. It's never, you know, you want it. We all would love a 2.5-hour game, but, you know, sometimes it's going to go into three and a half hours. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of pitching changes. Maybe that's one thing they can limit. But still, you know, the games are going to be played the way they're going to be played. And, you know, quite frankly, despite all its flaws, it's still a beautiful sport.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's, I'm going to give you a shameless plug here for a second, Ari. I'm just thinking back as I'm listening to this about your podcast interview with Jackie Redman. And you asked her kind of a similar question, and I loved her answer. Because she said something to the effect of, you know, yes, baseball is a long game. And when you look at it in the large scope of things, yes, it's a long game and it can be kind of boring. But when you break it down, I don't find it boring, but I understand why certain people do. But when you break it down and you look at an individual at bat as one event, and you look at it as she talked about how the momentum and the excitement builds throughout the game until that crucial moment in the game. And I agree with her 100%. And, you know, I struggle with the whole instant gratification wave of the world these days. And while I do think baseball has to be aware of that and continue to try and attract a young fan base, I don't want them messing with my game too much more than they already have. I don't know. I personally hate the intentional walk rule. It drives me nuts every time I see it. But I'm a bit of a purist.
Maybe people just need to go to more ball games. Because when I'm at a ball game, if it goes 3.5 hours, you know, it doesn't feel like 3.5 hours because there's so much going on, so much excitement, so much discussion, and, well, you know, so much beer. But that's a whole other thing. You know, I think people are more commenting about how long it is when they're watching it on TV and that. You know, maybe it's just you have to be there and breathe in the air and have a few hot dogs and you know, have some buddies out there and, you know.
One thing I'd get rid of is the 40-man roster expansion, because in September that would take too long because they have so many pitchers. I think you should, like, you could expand 40, but you have to declare, like, a certain amount of pitchers that you can, like, play that game. Because, like,
you
the
mean
Yankees
to make it more strategic?
Was,
is that
enough? Yeah, well, like, last September the Yankees were pretty much, like, every other batter, it was a new pitcher because they had, like, 20 pitchers to go through.
Interesting. So that goes down to, you know, it's funny, I asked more on the business side, but you guys gave me some fantastic reflections on the strategic nature of the game. And I agree, I don't find a 2.5-3 hour baseball game boring. But my concern is what the next generation of front office baseball leadership, you know, Manfred and on, do to keep the game fresh, exciting, without getting rid of those organic qualities that we like. I mean, Chris, you brought up the intentional walk. How amazing is it to think that when a pitcher has to throw 4 baseballs out of the strike zone to let a runner actually get on base, that runner could then potentially either hit the ball or watch the ball be thrown away? Isn't that what we love about baseball, that for a predictable game, it's probably the most unpredictable organic game?
I remember being a pitcher, you know, in my youth, and that was the most stressful thing I had to do in any given game. Was, you know, I could, you know, throw a fastball high and tight, didn't bother me at all, but to lob one to the catcher to put a man on first base, for some reason, it was a stressful thing, and I know a lot of other pitchers felt the same. And to me, I don't know, I tune in and just wait for a pitcher to lean out across. Like, you know, I'm thinking of Miguel Cabrera a few years ago that just whacked one into right field when everybody was kind of wasn't expecting it. And I love it. I absolutely love that kind of stuff.
You know, you talked about making the game fresh and exciting. You just need superstar players to do that. You know, think about what Michael Jordan did for the NBA in basketball. The NBA didn't come up with Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan came to the NBA and you know, made it what it is today. You know, if you have exciting players like Aaron Judge, and if that exciting player is in New York, for example, you know, that's all you need. That's all you really need. If there's some exciting ball players and some cool things happening on the field, people will come.
And sorry to jump right back in, but I think you hit the nail on the head. The fact that Aaron Judge is in New York, you know, you think about guys like Mike Trout, who's one of the best baseball players we've seen in decades, but he just doesn't, at least in where I'm at, he doesn't get the kind of exposure that a guy with that kind of talent should get. So you put him in a bigger market, like, you know, with Judge in New York, and that's going to be good for baseball. And it'll be interesting to see where guys like Trout and Harper and Machado and Donaldson end up with their next contracts. But that could be a good thing for baseball, as much as I don't even like to think about Donaldson in another jersey. You're right. Michael Jordan changed the landscape of basketball. Vince Carter did the same thing in Canada with the Raptors. One player can make it, you know, a generational player can make a difference.
You know, I just had a shiver thinking about Aaron Judge and Bryce Harper all wearing pinstripes.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
That's Star Wars 9. That's a whole new trilogy of how baseball gets absolutely dominated by two of the most pound-for-pound talented players that it has to offer. But, you know, how horribly can one feel knowing that there is no salary cap? The Blue Jays theoretically could spend $300 million if they chose to. And considering the kind of free agents that will be available, I'm going to start with you, Eric. Do you think the Blue Jays should take advantage of the upcoming 2018 free agency period to seriously participate in what will be a nuclear arms race for baseball talent?
It doesn't hurt to kick the tires, to be honest. You know, but it just... you know, the Blue Jays are a little bit different in terms of their ownership. They're just one part of a huge conglomerate, and each little parts of that conglomerate have certain spending limits. And, you know, if Mark Shapiro can go to the board and say, hey, let's throw a lot of change at this guy, I'm sure they would be interested in doing it. But, you know, it's doesn't hurt to at least try.
I'm with you on that, too. And I think the market will dictate what happens as far as how heavily the Blue Jays get in. I'm not a fan of spending $30 million or more on a player. You know, Harper, there's been talk of just astronomical numbers when his contract comes up, and the same with Trout. I'm not a big fan of committing that kind of that much of a payroll to one player, but when there are that many key free agents available at the same time, it's entirely possible that we see the market dip a little bit for somebody. Say Harper gets the massive contract, Machado gets the massive contract, and you know, the big buyers with a huge budget are looking at Josh Donaldson and going, well, you know, he's 33. Well, maybe that's when the Blue Jays can swoop in and go, well, here, Josh, you know, we will pay you pretty well, you know? So I think that's where that's going to be the big thing, is if they see a potential quote unquote bargain in that market, you know, Donaldson can probably, if he was a free agent this coming off season, he'd probably be pushing that $30 million mark. But in the same off season as some of the other guys, I don't know that he would.
Yeah. I think the Jays should look at like maybe some starters. Cause if they do, like, sell off and trade Leonardo Estrada, they're going to need, like, a nice, like not a top guy. They should definitely look at, like, a third guy. But they should definitely, like, check in on the big names, because getting a big name, it will help sell tickets, too. It will help keep fans. Because a lot of these fans are from, like, 2015 when they started winning. And if they start to lose, maybe some will fall off some more.
Well, that's the great fear, isn't it? Right? That if this team ends up getting to that 500 perennial plateau that they can't get away from. They can't even reach it, let alone find a way to get over it. What will happen? Is there any truth to this doom and gloom mentality that if they start selling off assets, that people will in fact stop? I mean, I've always argued it is, but do you feel that way, Chris? Do you think it'll be 12,000-15,000 in August and September if this team starts taking away pieces?
I think it's possible. I mean, the Blue Jays may have changed, but I remember writing an article right before the All-Star break that they were the top AL attendance team, and I think they were third or fourth in all of baseball for attendance. I don't think we can expect that to stay the same unless they start making a comeback and actually get themselves back into contention. It's going to drop off. I'd be surprised if it fell that far, just because of the amount of interest that's been generated in the area in the last couple of years. I think there's the Fairweather fans, and then there's the people, you know, I've got some friends that weren't really that big of fans of the Blue Jays prior to the 2015 run, but I'm confident that they'll continue to follow the team now, you know, even through a rebuild, just because of the relationship that they've made with cheering for this franchise. So I don't think it'll get that bad, but it's going to fall off unless they get back into the race.
Yeah, it'll probably happen. They'll probably go down to, you know, somewhere between 15,000 to 20,000. But you know what? I'd rather be in a stadium with 20,000 baseball fans than in a stadium with, you know, a packed house. And don't get me wrong, 50,000 screaming fans is great, but, you know, a good chunk of them are there just because the Blue Jays are in vogue and, you know, they're the hot, trendy item.
So true. So true, Eric. Very true. That's right. It's never a great thing to wrap up on that kind of note, but at the same token, I like it because it's realistic. And I think that's what's going to determine what happens over the next few weeks with this front office. Are they prepared to see who blinks first? Because for many years, this organization, especially during the Ricciardi era, had this elitist notion that if the fans showed up, it would justify them spending money. And one thing that Anthopoulos did so well, and you mentioned that, Eric, was he got rid of that. He basically sat down with Paul Beeston, and they agreed that the only way for fans of this team to understand how seriously committed this franchise is to them is if they go out and make the moves and spend the money. And over the next few weeks, we're going to learn what this new regime is all about and if fans have any reason to be optimistic about the future, in many respects, cynical about what happens next. I have been speaking with Eric Rosenheck of Definitely Not Jays Talk, Cole Shelton of Bluebird Banter, and Chris Henderson of JB's Journal. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me this afternoon on the Roundtable.
Thank you for
having me. Pleasure as always.
Yeah, thanks.